From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, our Project Milwaukee Black Men in Prison series continues with stories of several men currently behind bars. Writer Patrick Ness writes for young audiences and is adamant about not patronizing them.
I think the worst thing you can say to a teenager who's having a difficult time is you'll grow out of it. Well, you will grow out of it, but that's completely beside the point because you're not going to grow out of it this afternoon. You've still got to go through it, and it's still painful.
And Shannon Carey talks about her mid-career shift that led to launching the band Luray.
I was a social worker. I got focused on doing that. And then I, like in 2005 or 6, we heard this little bluegrass band in Vermont, and they had a banjo, and I was like, wow, you know, I think I kind of want to like learn a new instrument.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Between now and next spring, WUWM and Milwaukee Public Television are examining the issues surrounding the high rate of incarceration among African-American men in Milwaukee County. The story features a lot of numbers and statistics, but each of those statistics, in turn, has its own story. And while experts can offer their analysis on why so many black men are serving time, each of the men themselves has his own reasons. WUWM's Susan Bentz stepped inside the statistics with a visit to the Milwaukee County House of Correction in Franklin. We meet five Milwaukee residents serving time there.
Paris Billups walked into the small visiting room with attitude. He describes himself as an intelligent guy on the competitive side who's had to figure out how to handle anger, starting with an altercation with a fellow high school student. Billups was 15.
I hurt somebody and could have been taken to Wales or Ethan Allen's or whatever, but the judge has sentenced me to a year of community service, where I had to read to kids for a whole year. If I did that the whole year every Saturday, I wouldn't have to go to any other further recommendation. So I did that. I completed that, and it helped me a lot.
So you had anger from somewhere, and you had a hard time controlling it?
I don't know. I think it was just a natural thing. I've always been an aggressive kid, very competitive.
A jealousy-induced spat led to Billups' first prison term.
You know, I felt a need to protect myself, so to speak. And I took it overboard, went further on the physical aspect.
This person survived what was
Yes. Horrible bodily harm, substantial battery. So it was very, you know,
like
substantial.
Yeah.
Actually, his jaw was... It's always broken.
While in prison, Billups plugged into anger management courses. After his release, Billups discovered he had more to learn. His wife had just given birth to their son. Billups wanted to pitch in and pick up baby supplies. That meant plugging into the government WIC program. Billups' wife's name, not his, was registered. Billups says he hit a roadblock with a store manager.
He told me that I couldn't redeem my items, and I care about my son, you know what I mean? So where I come from, when those things are being attacked, you know, that's when I become physical. He told me to get the hell out of the store with derogatory demeanor and everything about it, and a racist demeanor about it. I hit him. I hit him once, but I hit him.
So they sent you back in?
Yeah, they sent me back in. So I did that time.
And how long was that?
That was another year and a half.
Billups emerged at 23, anger not yet conquered. He erupted when the mother of his oldest child criticized Billups' wife on Facebook.
I felt my wife was being attacked in that way. It got to me. I pushed her on the ground, and she fell on ice. But it wasn't, you know, something where I beat her up. But I did push her on ice. So that's why I'm currently in here. But along the way, I've taken up anger management throughout all the incarcerations. And this time, I can honestly say the concept that the teacher has brought to me, it made me realize the anger has always been my thoughts and my interpretation, my ego that has been bruised.
Nearly 26 now, Billups says he's prepared to take on the world and provide for his family.
Do you feel any sense that your options are more limited having come back into the system again?
You know, it all depends on who you are as a person, how you conduct yourself. And I've even with my criminal background before even this particular situation, I utilized my resume along with my personality and, you know, was able to get a job 4 months after I came out of my second prison bed or that second incarceration, 4 months. Mm-hmm. 4 months, and I got into school within 4 months. Mm-hmm. So it's just depending on who you are and how people perceive of you and what you do to create that perception.
40 years, Billups Sr., Larnell Friend paints a far less optimistic picture.
My life is practically over with, but these younger dudes, they're more deadlier. They're dangerous. They're not going to accept their lives being tangled with, like with these people that set this, they just set this time status thing up the way. If somebody see me do something out here, I'm going to kill them. And I'm telling you this because I talk to them. I talk to them. You know, ain't no going to put me back in no cage no more.
Friend's frustration teeters at the boiling point throughout our conversation. He's in the House of Corrections now after decades of being incarceration free. Friend's family moved to Milwaukee when he was a child. His parents had been cotton farmers in Tennessee. Friend maintains that as a boy, he was intimidated to plead guilty to multiple petty crimes, things like stealing soda pop from a church and cash from a neighboring restaurant. Friend says by age 19, he had evolved into a real criminal.
How to hotwire cars and how to burglarize and this and how to break locks and stuff and safes.
That led to prison time. But Friend says he went on to a normal life, raised a family, ran a trucking business. His dusty felony record came back to haunt him last year. Friend was found guilty of possessing a gun. He says it belonged to an acquaintance. Friend insists he was forced to pick it up when his son's dog attacked him.
So I get the gun and shoot him. I felt what I did was just for me. I'm fighting it down for my life. And I'm doing time for something back then, right now. I'm in my house. And this dog attacks me, and I killed it because it was trying to kill me.
38-year-old Deron Banks echoes Friend's frustration. He's serving 9 months for being attached to a firearm he says wasn't his. Banks was visiting his mom at the time.
Police come in my mother's house and has a search warrant for drugs, find no drugs. The gun was registered in my mother's name. Just because I was in the same room that the gun was at, I get charged with felony with possession because I got this felony under my name for failure to support.
Banks acknowledges he made some bad decisions after graduating from Custer High School and before he got backed up paying child support.
Once I graduated, I was working at a temp service. I smoked marijuana, made a couple of bad decisions. Driving tickets, that was to the most. And besides that, once my baby mother got mad at me, she started calling the child support agency, and they just put warrants, and that's it.
At 20 years of age, Banks was incarcerated in northern Wisconsin.
14 months up north with killers, real killers, and you in there because you couldn't find no job, and here goes somebody next to you that actually murdered somebody. It's like, oh, man, it put a damper on your brain. It really messed you up mentally.
Since then, Banks been in and out of jail.
20 to 30 times for a week, from a week up to a month. You know, if you get a ticket or you get caught driving or anything like that, and you don't got your license.
Banks worked a string of temp jobs over the years. He says it's hard to hold a decent-paying job when you're repeatedly hauled off to jail.
Until you just stop it and do a whole totally 360.
Banks says for the last couple of years, he's been on course. He and his uncle started a home improvement business that's waiting for his release. Banks says he's providing for his three kids, ages 9 to 16.
I got two little girls and a son, and I point them out and I don't keep no secrets so they won't make the mistakes that I have made.
Antoine Flores said his life's trajectory as a teenager, growing up in a drug and gang-infested Northside Milwaukee neighborhood. While his three siblings emerged successfully on solid ground, Flores says he wanted to fit in.
I had sold drugs before, smoked marijuana and everything. Used to drink. When I was 16, there's a liquor store by my house, and I used to go in there. They thought I was older. I used to go in there and buy 40 ounces of beer and stuff, standing on the corners, drinking and stuff with the older guys.
So the drugs, marijuana, what else?
Just marijuana. A lot of people that was on crack cocaine and everything. I was just one of the lucky few that didn't go that route.
Flores ended up in jail at 18 for driving a stolen car and weapons possession charges. He says at the time, incarceration suited him fine. By the time he hit his mid-20s, he'd been back 3 times, and he didn't mind.
We used to better walk the yard whenever we want. We just sign out on a piece of paper. We used to better smoke our cigarettes, go to canteen. We had microwaves and hot water there, and it was like a home away from a home, but you just had the guards telling you what you can do and what you can't do. And but as long as you live under their rules and stuff, it was pretty much just like being at home.
By the end of that last, or into that last time around, did you feel that same way?
No, I didn't feel that way because I was telling myself, what type of life is this? This is not no positive. Like, what can I show my daughter and stuff? And then my mother and them, they used to always come and visit me all the time. And then, like, around the third time, she told me, well, if you go back to jail, you go back to prison again, I'm not going to be coming to see you. And I think that was opened my eyes, because just sitting in prison, not having getting no mail from nobody, nobody coming to visit you, anything like that, it seemed like you just in there by yourself, like a lot of people now. You know, even here at the House of Correction, there's a lot of people that don't get visits, don't get mail, or don't have nowhere to go when they get out. And it's like they just stuck up in here. So I had to open my own eyes and ask myself, is this the life you want to live the rest of your life? And I choose not to live like this no more.
By the age of 32, Flores says he'd successfully launched a home remodeling business. So why, at 39, is he at the House of Corrections now? Flores violated a restraining order he didn't even know existed.
Me and the guy had got into it, and we got to fight, and he went and put a restraining order on me, and I didn't know it was on me. I went to the police station to get a parking permit, get some papers, and they ran my name and said I had a warrant out for me. When I found out, I wasn't mad at him because I knew I was wrong, and I'm man enough to accept my responsibilities. When I was younger, I probably would have tried to fight it or try to go after him and stuff like that, but I done grew up now, so I accept my responsibility and got the 6 months that the judge had ordered me to do here now.
By the time this story airs, 41-year-old James Collins has been released from the Milwaukee County House of Correction. When I met him, the Milwaukee resident was wrapping up a 65-day sentence for driving after revocation. Translation?
Driving with no license. But it stemmed from being arrested for driving while I had been drinking. All this stemmed from that. That's why my license was revoked. That's why I'm doing a sentence for driving after revocation.
As you've guessed by now, there's a backstory. It started in Beloit, Wisconsin, where Collins was raised by his mom. When he was 15, she died. Her loss devastated Collins.
I don't know what else I can say. She was my everything. She was my first teacher. She was person that listened to me and gave me advice and told me don't do certain things and why not to do them. And she was everything to me.
He moved in with his dad, a person Collins barely knew and who was in and out of prison.
From about age 15 to about 18, I think I'd say I kind of raised myself. And I went to prison when I was 20 years old. Like I said, I was pretty much on my own and making my own decisions and choices, and obviously, not all of them were the right ones.
So what choice was it that led to prison?
Battery, fighting people, just not doing what was right.
How long were you in prison the first time?
The first time I went to prison, I received a 5-year prison sentence.
Collins calls the experience uneventful.
Basically, I felt like I was being warehoused and put away for a little while.
Did you get any kind of counseling?
Yeah, I received, they sent me, when I was on my way out of prison, I went to Thompson Correctional Center, and there they did criminal thinking. You know, they tried to show us a different way, a way to look at, you know, taking responsibility for what we did. It wasn't where we were blaming other people for it. No one sent us to prison but ourselves. I received my HSED, did some job training there, had a job in prison, earned money. When I left prison, I had about $4,000. So I wasn't just broke when I got out of jail. I had a little start.
Is there any way you can look at that time as you're being perhaps better off than when you went in?
I wouldn't say I was better off. I'd say I came out with a different way of thinking, but...
So what was your way of thinking coming out?
That I didn't want to go back to jail. I wanted to do things different. I wanted to be, you know, a better person, try to be a better man, you know. And I have to say, I didn't go back to prison after that. You know, and that's been almost 25 years ago, and I haven't been back to prison, so.
Yet Collins describes most of those years in between as chaotic. He worked pretty consistently, but never stayed with one job very long.
I worked for a bike manufacturer. I worked for a place that built yard swings.
Did guns or drugs, were they part of your life at all or not?
Well, I still hung around people that I had associated with before who were involved in things like that, the selling drugs and the criminal element. I guess I'd have to consider myself lucky for not getting caught up in some of those things I was still involved with.
Now Collins claims he intends to abandon chaos and strive for calm. He thinks the bindery job he'd held for a record 9 months before being sentenced will be waiting for him. Collins missed his just-turned 9-year-old daughter's birthday, so he planned to take her to the zoo the day after his release, by bus. Memories of his mother bubbled up through our conversation.
I think I'm still trying to get to that place where I think that, you know, she'd be content and happy with the way I am or the way things are going for me. I'm on my way, but I don't believe I've gotten there yet.
For Like Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Susan Bentz's story was part of the Project Milwaukee Black Men in Prison series, produced in conjunction with Milwaukee Public Television. You can hear all the segments in the 6-month series at wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. We'll take a break now, but keep listening. Writer Patrick Ness does not soft pedal tough issues to his audience of young readers. We'll hear about his latest novel for young adults when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Friday on the show, we spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Paul Harding about his latest novel, Enon, which dealt with a parent's loss of his only child. The book is a challenging read, and it's for an adult audience. Writer Patrick Ness also takes on death in his latest novel, More Than This, but he writes for young adult readers. Ness's protagonist, Seth, dies in the first sentence of the book, but the story is just beginning. Ness will fill us in on the details in a moment. We learn, though, in the story that Seth had just moved from England to the United States. That's the reverse direction from the author, who grew up in the States but now makes his home in London. Patrick Ness tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North that having a foot in two worlds is actually pretty important for him.
It's a good place for a writer to be, I've always thought, being an expat, because you're always a writer is good on the edges and observing and looking. But what happens is in the first 3 pages, he drowns and he dies unambiguously. And there's no way that this is a question mark over his death. But then he wakes up and he wakes up in an abandoned world. He wakes up in the neighborhood that he grew up in England, instead of America, where he lives now. And it's empty. No planes, no cars, no people. Everything covered in mud. Plants overgrown. So, you know, the question of the book is, why is he there? What kind of place is this? So the fact that it's that metaphor of waking up in an empty world, coupled with the idea of not quite fitting in, both of those are extremely teenage concerns. Because I've always thought the MO of a teenager, even the popular ones, is to feel different. That's just what it is to be a teenager. And that can be good, it can be bad, but it can also feel so lonely. When you think that nobody understands it. So, you know, here we have a boy waking up in an empty world, and how much lonelier can you get? You can't get any lonelier. But of course, that's not the loneliness that bothers him. It's a different kind. And just also being the boy who came from somewhere else in his high school, every kid feels like that. Even the popular kids feel like that. And so they're just good ways to represent an internal teenage emotional state.
And then the two teenagers that he meets in this empty world that he thinks is empty anyway also bring their own feelings and senses of being so terribly alone in the world.
Yeah, which I think is just any teenager anywhere recognize that feeling. And it was so important that they're called Regine and Tomash. And they were just so important because the whole theme of the book is seeing that there is, well, I mean, it's in the title, seeing that there's more. And I've always said that the blessing and the curse of being young is that whatever you feel takes up all the space you have, which is great. So that's why the young feel invincible when they're feeling good, because you can't think, can't conceive of feeling any other way. But when things are bad, it sucks all the air out of the room and it feels like it will never change. That how bad you feel now is how bad you will always feel. And so a big, big theme of the book is just to say what you are feeling is real and it's serious and I'm not dismissing it. And I think the worst thing you can say to a teenager who's having a difficult time is you'll grow out of it. Well, you will grow out of it, but that's completely beside the point because you're not going to grow out of it this afternoon. You've still got to go through it and it's still painful. So it's to acknowledge that, you know, that teenage pain is real pain. But it's saying that in addition to that, there is more. There is something else. There is something, there's always something apart from yourself. There's always a different point of view you can take. And so when he meets Regine and Tomáš, they are completely different from him. And they aren't people who he'd imagine. So this question of, am I in an imagined place, is thrown into question again because he meets these two people that he wouldn't come up with. And it's, again, it's just a way to say, there's always more. Even if you think that's impossible, there's always more. There's always an additional thing you can feel. It doesn't replace the bad feeling, but you can feel it alongside it. And that complication, well, that's what growing up is.
I was going to say, that's a very adult way of thinking about it. And one of the things that happens to Seth is that he comes to realize that in some way by the end of the book, that there is more and he's on that road. Even though he's dead.
Maybe.
Maybe. Maybe. Because that's a whole nother plot twist.
Yeah.
But, you know, he comes to that point where he does make that realization. It's like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
There is another door to open.
Yeah, which is that. I mean, that to me is the process of growing up. And I've written in different ways about this. I mean, in A Monster Calls, to me, that's a book about acknowledging that you can believe contradictory things and still live, still somehow find a way to live your life, or that you're believing two things that can't coexist. And it's kind of the same thing. It's just understanding that, not diminishing a problem, but he learns, like, okay, I have another way to look at what's happened to me. And why couldn't the easier way to look at it be just as true as the most painful version? Why does the most painful version have to be the truth? So yeah, I think he really does. I hope he really does. So I think I say that as growing up, but I say that as if all adults have this magical thing where we all go, oh yes, oh yeah, I get perspective all the time. Of course we don't. It's an ongoing thing, but this is a good first step.
I was going to say, as you were talking about that, what was making me smile was the idea that we all have to learn that over and over and over.
Over and over and over and over again.
I don't think you ever learn it for good.
No, and you know, and good. Because, you know, I think as humans, I think we're just really appealing messes. And I think we'd be a lot less interesting if we weren't. And that we make mistakes, that we make the same mistakes. And sometimes you learn. But I don't know. It's all part of being human. And what more glorious thing is that than that?
A friend of mine says we all learn the hard way or not at all.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. And often not at all.
But yes, and often not at all.
No, an easy lesson is never taken. Yeah.
No. You were here talking to high school students. Is that correct?
Yeah, just done a bunch of – I've been on a book tour. And so I've done some book festivals and stuff on the East Coast and D.C. and Manhattan and Brooklyn. And I was in St. Louis, and for the past several days, I have been talking to huge groups of teenagers, including this morning here in Milwaukee. And it was, I think there were 1,000 yesterday when I was in North Chicago, and today there were about 500. And they were a great group. They were a great group today.
How are they responding to this idea, these ideas that you bring forth in your books?
Most of the ones I've been talking to have done big school reads of A Monster Calls, actually. And it's kind of the same kind of stuff. And they respond really well. They love that. You know what it is? They just love that somebody's taking them seriously. And they love that somebody is talking to them rather than down at them. And in fact, somebody said that today, you know, that I was treating them like I would talk to anybody. And what a relief that is. And what joy you can get from a teenager like that. And I know whenever anybody thinks of teenagers, they think of their own teenagers. And well, your own teenagers are only like that to you, you know. To the rest of the world, they're interesting and different and curious and nice and fun. And they're probably like that to you as well. But so I don't know. I get the best of them. I get the best of them because for an hour, I'm neither their parent nor their teacher. And so I have some fun and I talk right to them. And I.
And you talk about difficult things. You talk about death.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about that sadness. You talk about that sense of isolation, mm-hmm. of never feeling connected or that you never will be connected. And as you say, take them seriously.
I do. And then I also tell them naughty jokes. So,
which I'm
together,
sure they love,
yes,
too.
Yes, they absolutely love. And you know, and they also, when they, because they always want to test your boundaries and they always want to challenge you. So I bite back. So, and it works. It's great. It's good fun. And they really were glorious today. And they really, really were very interested about, like, they wanted to know what happens to Connor after the end of Monster Calls. And they want to know, you wrote a tough book about war. You know, why? You know, why did you want to talk about that? They want to know. And they are always thinking about heavy things, dark things. And I have said over and over and over again, whenever my books have sometimes been accused of being dark or, you know, too old for teenagers. Well, one, all you have to do is read what a teenager writes. Teenage fiction that they write themselves is much darker than anything any YA author would ever, ever publish. And so I think that to not address dark stuff is to abandon a teenager and leave them to fend for themselves. And I think that's the immoral position. Because if I can engage, if I can tell the truth about what's dark, I can say, yes, I know, I take you seriously. But there's also this. When I say, but there's also this, they'll believe me because I haven't lied about what's difficult. And I don't know, isn't the truth always the best option?
I think so.
Well, yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah, most of the time. Most of the time. Certainly in fiction.
Well, and I'd say in life too. I mean, it's not always the easiest.
No,
it's usually not.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I would
tact and style.
Yeah,
yes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's ways of telling the truth.
There is an art, indeed.
Yeah, and there's an art, I think, sometimes to telling the truth that helps make sometimes unpalatable things a little more accessible, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, and when you're 13, 14, you feel constantly like you're being lied to. And part of that is because part of the time you are, you know, people think you're too young to know. So the truth gets bent. And it's that awful stretch of life where you know more than you should. And should is a dangerous word always. But it's like in A Monster Calls. Of course, Connor knows exactly what's going on with his ill mother. Nobody wants to tell him the truth. And he doesn't really want to hear it. Of course he knows. And in More Than This, in the new book, Seth is just... He knows way more than what's going on in his life than his parents do, and they have no idea. And that is so common. And, you know, maybe sometimes it's necessary just to find your own way. But I don't know, just engage with a teenager. I say engage with a teenager as an equal, and people all immediately take umbrage. But you know what I mean. Just talk to them. Don't immediately assume you know what their answer is going to be. Don't immediately assume that they're going to give you attitude. Ask a question, a genuine question. Might be surprised.
They're human beings.
Totally.
And we all went through it.
Uh-huh. And I don't know why adults forget it so easily. We shouldn't.
I think maybe because it's painful.
Yeah, but like childbirth, you sort of block out the pain. You know, that's why we don't remember pain as a species, because, you know, we would never do anything if we remembered pain. So, I don't know. Have some compassion for your teenage self. I think that's the start.
What is it about that time frame that appeals to you as a writer? What are you able to explore that you couldn't explore, say, with quote-unquote adult fiction?
Well, it's a borderland. And borderlands are always interesting for fiction. Always, always, always. So much fiction is about one borderland or another, crossing a border, mixing of borders, the falling of a border. And it's just a very, very interesting one, these steps from childhood to adulthood. Teenagers are such a great audience to write for because they are far less snobby than adult readers can be. And there, of course, there are some unsnobby adult readers, but teenagers as a group, they just want to be told a good story. They don't care where it goes, what it's about. They just want it to be good and real and something they can relate to. And so what freedom is that? I mean, that's a great bargain to make. Yes, I will respect you. And in return, you'll follow me to wherever I take the story. What a great deal to make with a reader. It's the best kind of deal. So,
and you can't do that with adults?
You have to do it in a different way. The agreement has to be much more subtle, and it has to be... there's much more cajoling and much more convincing. And I don't mind that. That's absolutely fine. But with a teenager, they just want a rollicking good tale. So if you can do that, then you can slip in all the stuff you want. You can slip in all the themes you want. You can slip in all the jokes you want. And it's just fun. It's liberating. It's liberating. I mean, I'll continue to write for adults and teens, when, you know, whatever the idea dictates. But I love it. And again, trying not to be a snob about it.
So tell me a little bit about the book that's coming out in January for adults.
It's called The Crane Wife. It is based on a Japanese folktale called The Crane Wife. And it's the folktale is about a sailmaker who finds an injured crane with an arrow through its wing. And it saves the crane. And then the crane flies off. And the next day, a woman enters the sailmaker's life. They fall in love. They marry. She says, I will weave sails for you that you can sell, but you can't watch me weave. And so she weaves sails. She weaves all these beautiful sails. They grow richer and richer and richer. And the man's greed gets the best of him. And he breaks down the door while she's weaving to demand that she weave more. And of course, she's been the crane all along, weaving the sails from her feathers. And seeing her breaks the spell, and she flies away. And it's a tragic ending. The book starts at the same place. It starts with a man, another expatriate American, living in London, who finds an injured crane in his back garden with an arrow through its wing somehow in the middle of freezing London. And he takes the arrow from its wing and it flies away. And the next day, a woman enters his life. And the stories diverge from there. I'm not really interested in material greed, but sort of maybe emotional greed. How is a nice man greedy? And I think it's the greed for what we all are greedy for when we fall in love. You want to know that it's true. You're greedy for knowledge that it's true. And it gets him in trouble. But I think it's a fun book, and I think it's a funny book, and I think it's a warm book. And that's a nice thing to write now and again.
Exactly.
Yeah, a funny book now and again. I hope people like it.
Patrick Ness, as always, such a pleasure. And thank you so much for stopping by. I know you're on your way to points. When do you get home?
A few days from now. I'm nearly at the end. So I think it's time for a bunch of sleep is what I think it's time for. Yeah, yeah. I have two books out in about 6 months apart. That's a lot of books.
That's a lot of books, and it's a lot of travel.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for stopping by.
My absolute pleasure.
Patrick Ness's latest novel for young adults is called More Than This. Ness's previous work has won awards, including the Carnegie Medal and the Galaxy National Book Award in the UK. He spoke with Bonnie North on a recent trip to Milwaukee. We are just 3 short weeks away from the end of 2013. Over those 21 days, we and many other news outlets will analyze some of the top stories from a variety of subject areas, things like business and science and sports. But we kick off the look back at the year that was with our political satirist.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with the top 10 comedic news stories of 2013. Now here's the deal. The top 10 comedic news stories of 2013 are in no way to be confused with the top 10 legitimate news stories of 2013. No, no, no. They are as different as soybeans and lug nuts, Bluetooth and dental floss, palm fronds and those weird cone-shaped collars that dogs wear to keep them from chewing their butts. These are the stories from the year thus far that most lend themselves to mocking and scoffing and taunting, as determined by the Executive Council of the Comics, Clowns, Jesters, and Satirists Union, which is me. Number 10, Barack Obama leadership skills, like saying Fukushima sushi. Number 9, Anthony Weiner attempts a comeback. Weiner is both his name and the source of most of his problems. Number 8, Pope Francis turns out to be a liberal Democrat, while Pope Benedict keeps busy updating his Christian Mingle profile. Number 7, Edward Snowden runs first to China and then to Russia. Why? To escape government persecution, which is like joining the army because you're tired of people telling you what to do. Number 6, Ted Cruz reads Green Eggs and Ham on the floor of the Senate, then misinterprets the moral of the book. Number 5, Toronto Mayor Rob Ford admits using crack during one of his drunken stupors, yes, plural, only to see his approval rating shoot up 5 points. Not saying Obama should do the same thing, but... Number 4, domestic spying revelations. Turns out the best way to keep the NSA from following your every move is by becoming one of its employees. Number 3, Dennis Rodman, roving ambassador. What's next? Mike Tyson, poet laureate? Kim Kardashian, molecular chemistry consultant? Tim Tebow, NFL quarterback? Number 2, the government shuts down and we almost default again. And then you know what happens. We have to move back in with Britain. And the number 1 comedic news story of 2013. The Affordable Care Act website debacle.
Most people decide to let the NSA handle the whole thing. After all, they have all the information and probably know which plan best fits. For Lake Effect, I'm Will Durst.
Lake Effect political satirist Will Durst is a Milwaukee area native who now lives in California's Bay Area. His latest book is Elect to Laugh, a hilarious common sense guide to American politics. One last break, and then a former UWM social work student completely shifts gears in her new career. We will hear the distinctive sound of Shannon Carey and her band Luray when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Shannon Carey used to live in Wisconsin. She grew up in Lake Geneva and last called the state home when she was earning her graduate degree at UW-Milwaukee. This past fall, though, she returned to Milwaukee having reinvented herself, or at least her career. She and her band, Luray, named for a part of Virginia not too far from her now Maryland home, have carved out a niche in a genre that defies most attempts to label it. But people have tried, calling it anything from ambient bluegrass to chamber folk. It bears some kinship, literally, to the indie folk of Eau Claire's Bon Iver. Carey's brother Sean, who is a percussionist and the backing vocalist for Bon Iver, produced Luray's recent CD, The Wilder. Luray joined us in Studio C1 and played a few songs, including this one called Already There. It's not the last point in the sky where I stop and sing. Trick of the air, passing of time, and I'm already there. Shannon Carey and Luray, that was great. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And before we get any further, why don't I just have you go around the room and introduce yourselves. Tell us who's playing, starting with you.
Okay, my name's Shannon Carey, and I play banjo and sing.
I'm Sarah Gilbert. I'm from Washington, D.C., and I play the keys and sing backup vocal and a little bit of acoustic guitar.
Thomas Jones, right here from Milwaukee. I'm filling in for C.J. Wolf, who is couldn't be on this leg of the tour.
Brian Cruz from Richmond, Virginia, and I play upright and electric bass.
I'm Gabe Wisniewski. I play the tambourine.
Well,
and also the guitar.
Well, thanks to all of you. First of all, you started with a track called Already There, and it features ukulele very prominently. And what amazes me is that you have this really big, deep, atmospheric sound, and yet the ukulele still manages to speak up in the middle of all of that. How did that emerge for you?
Well, I really like the ukulele. I never really played it before, and I just thought I would buy one and see what happens, and I thought this song would be perfect for it. I actually wrote it on banjo. That's my primary instrument, my like songwriting arm, but then I transposed it to uke. And yeah, I think it's kind of cool. Like it gives it like a shimmery effect or something. It's kind of weird. And
It's like a voice out in the wilderness.
Yeah, I love ukulele.
Now, the publicity materials surrounding the CD talk about how you, and I'll quote here, rediscovered your love of music in Northern California in 2006, and I want to ask about how that happened. But first, what happened to your love of music in the first place, that it was lost?
I know. You know, I always loved music. I think that maybe love is, you know, you never stop loving music, but you stop playing music sometimes. And I stopped playing music. I was a social worker. I got focused on doing that and, you know, friends and family. And then in 2005 or six, we heard this little bluegrass band in Vermont and they had a banjo. And I was like, wow, you know, I think I kind of want to like learn a new instrument. And then I also like had a dream later on that I got a guitar for Christmas, but I was like, oh man, I wish that was a banjo when I woke up. And I was like, I think I want to play banjo. So it kind of just started organically. Like I, you know, was like, I kind of want to learn a new instrument, and banjo was it. And I got a teacher and started playing bluegrass. Yeah, it did. It happened within a few months. Yeah.
Shannon came home and she said, I'm not doing music as much as I want to. And then a week later she said, I really like that bluegrass band we saw. And then a week later she was like, I think I'm going to play the banjo. And then a week later she had a banjo and a teacher.
Do you remember what the name of the bluegrass band you heard in Vermont was?
Yeah, no idea. It was like a little trio at a barn. Yeah.
Somewhere in Vermont, though, is right. This group that has had this major impact on your life.
That's true.
Yeah. Changed all of our lives.
Inspiration for all the little bands out there. If you think you're not getting heard, somebody out there is getting inspired.
Totally. And that's what I love about playing music now is that somebody else who maybe doesn't play music anymore is like, whoa, like maybe I can learn a new instrument or go back to playing guitar or whatever.
And so talk about how that almost experimentation, how did it evolve into the sound that is with us today?
Well, I was playing bluegrass once a week with friends, and it was really fun. But I guess I wanted something that would move me the way that some of the other music I listened to did. And so I was talking to my brother about this, and he was like, you should just try strumming it. And I, you know, when you get into a certain like genre of music, like bluegrass, it was honestly so hard to break out of the way that you play. So it was a slow process. I had to just, you know, be like, okay, I'm just going to try playing without picks. Like even that was weird. I just started experimenting with covers. That's the first thing I did, like banjo covers of songs I liked in other genres, like. One of the first ones was a Tallest Man on Earth cover on banjo. You know, you have to just break your mental bonds of, like, what you can and can't play with an instrument, which now it seems normal to play it how I do, but it wasn't for a really long time.
Well, and then so I gather you from there you tap into the kinds of stuff that you like to write about?
You know, melodies always just come to me. We're always coming to me, so it's just a matter of capturing them. And then as far as lyrics, it's just what inspires you and, like, what you're thinking about and what you see at the time, I guess.
Well, I have a lot more to ask, but first I'd just like to ask you to play another song, if you would.
All right. Well, the next song is track, I think, 4 on the album, and it's actually called Lou Ray, however you want to pronounce it. And the song was written before I named the band that, but it was sort of the whole concept for the album, this song. And my brother, when he was producing it, he was like, I'm going to just really focus on Lou Ray and make it, like, perfect and just, like, try to just have that inspire the rest of it. And so it is named after Lou Ray, Virginia. We had been visiting Lou Ray right around the time I was writing the first songs from the album, and it really inspired this song in particular. And even though it doesn't have the word Lou Ray in it, I just named the song that.
There were dreams in summer, lines on a page where it all makes sense. There were times when I was afraid and you were afraid. Can we make it okay? Thank you. small hideaway.
How important do you see sense of place being to what this sound is all about?
It's important to me. I don't know if it's important for the genre or anything. I wasn't really around a lot of other bluegrass players or anything when I was learning bluegrass, but it's just what surrounds you in your life. And as far as place, I think that moving around a lot, which we've done, we lived in California for a few years. I'm from Wisconsin. We lived in New Orleans for a year, and then we moved to D.C. 2 years ago. I think that being in different places, it affects me more. I think naming something after a place is kind of natural, and like when you're working on a creative piece, it's so important where you are.
Do you feel like when you play this, you can hear echoes of the D.C. area and Northern California and Southern Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, mostly I feel like it's connected to Virginia and D.C. And now we live in Maryland, so it's like the three states are really close together. For me, when I sing Tidal Ground, like, I'm picturing that marsh. But there's also a marsh in Wisconsin that I visited that same summer, and all of it kind of comes together.
Well, and one thing that I noticed actually looking at all of you as you were playing is that you all seem to be in a really content place when this music is coming out of your instruments and your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Is contentment where this comes from?
I mean, I'm content when I'm playing the music, but I don't think that the songs come from contentment. I think they come from more like a struggle against something, but I think when I'm playing the songs, it's such a triumph when you even finish a song and I know that what it's about and I know that I'm expressing that thing that I was trying to capture, that just being able to like play a finished song that I love and that I'm proud of, yeah, I mean, it's totally like I'm pretty peaced out.
And the rest of you?
Oh yeah, it's a joy playing these songs. I mean, I feel like they could stand alone just with banjo and vocals, you know, and it would be just as beautiful, but I feel like it's like our job to just like add more beauty, and everybody here is, I mean, there's such great people and everything to work with and play music with.
I will say, as Shannon's partner, it was, you know, it was tumultuous times for us when we moved from California to the D.C. area, and she's like launching a whole new career. I mean, she's had been working in social work for a long time, and as she said, had always been a music lover. But like, it's a fascinating thing to see somebody that you love struggle with a creative process. It's a really profound thing to witness, to be really close to. But it's also tenuous. It's like you hope to see your partner emerge from the other side, like with that feeling of victory that Shannon talked about, that having accomplished mm-hmm. something. So I'm definitely proud of where she's gotten.
Well, it really shows through. And thanks to all of you. Best of luck with this. And thank you so much for playing for us.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks
for having us.
So before we go, what are you going to play for us to take us out?
All right. So we're going to play Tidal Ground. It's kind of written about this marshy ground near where we lived in Virginia when I wrote this. And I just wrote it about the seasons passing and how when you would go to the marsh in spring, it looked different than when you came in the fall, and then the passing of time. So that's kind of what this song's about. Beneath this tidal ground, I'll follow you around. Beneath this tidal
Shannon Carey and Luray recorded in September in Studio C1 before a concert at Linneman's. Carey is originally from Lake Geneva and got her graduate degree from UWM. Her husband, guitarist Gabe Vishnevsky, went to Marquette. You can hear the full mini concert they played at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, Discover, the Waukesha-based national science magazine, named its top 100 science stories from 2013. We, of course, won't have time for all 100, but we'll hear the top five, plus what clocked in at number 94. Also, we'll learn about some noteworthy titles for the reader on your holiday shopping list, and we'll catch up with Wisconsin writer and musician Michael Perry, who just happens to have a noteworthy title in bookstores now. I'm Mitch Teich. You can keep track of everything happening around Milwaukee during the day with a quick visit to WUWM.com. But for us, until tomorrow, thanks so much for tuning in, and I sure hope you'll be with us again every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock, and have a great day. There is a sea.